The lights of Blackbury spread out below them. There weren't many of them. The occasional smudge from a car, the tiny gleam from a window where the moths had got at the blackout curtain. They ran on. There was the crunch of heavy boots on the road behind them, and Tom caught them up. "If you're wrong, there's going to be big trouble," he panted. "What if we're right?" said Kirsty. "I hope you're wrong." They were leaving the moor behind. There were hedges on either side of the road now. Tom's boots skidded to a halt. "Listen." They stopped. There was the grumbling of the thunder and the hiss of the rain, and behind the noises of the weather, a faint and distant droning. Gravel flew up as the young man started to run again. He'd been moving fast before, but now he flew down the road. They ran after him. The drone was much louder now. Johnny could hear it above the sound of his own breathing. Someone must notice it in the town, he thought. It fills the whole sky. Without saying anything, they all began to run faster. And at last, the siren began to wail. But the clouds were parting and the moon shone through, and there were shadows nosing through the rags of cloud, and Johnny could feel the unseen shapes turning over and over as they drifted towards the ground. First the allotments, and then the pickle factory, and then Paradise Street exploded gently like a row of roses opening. The petals were orange, tinged with black, and unfolded one after another as the bombs fell along the street. Then the sounds arrived. They weren't bangs, but crunches, punches, great wads of noise hammered into the head. Finally they died away, leaving only a distant crackling and the rising sound of a fire bell.
"Oh no," said Kirsty.
Tom had stopped. He stood and stared at the distant flames.
"We're time travellers," said Joless. "This isn't supposed to happen."
Johnny swayed slightly. The feeling was like flu, but much worse. He felt as if he were outside his own body, watching himself. It was the here-ness of here. It was the now-ness of now. People survived by not paying any attention to feelings like this. If you stopped and opened your head to them, the world would roll over you like a tank. Paradise Street was always going to be bombed. It was being bombed. Somewhere it would always have happened. You couldn't steer a train.
"That's what you think."
Somewhere... Flames flickered over the housetops. More bells were ringing.
"The bike wouldn't start," mumbled Tom. "The phone wouldn't work. There was a storm. I tried to get down here in time. How could it have been my fault?"
Somewhere. Johnny felt it again. The sense that he could reach out and go in directions not found on any map or compass, but only on a clock. It poured up from inside him until he felt that it was leaking out of his fingers. He hadn't got the trolley or the bags, but maybe... he could remember how it felt. "We've got time," he said.
"Are you mad?" said Kirsty.
"Are you going to come or not?" said Johnny.
"Where?"
Johnny took her hand and reached out for Joless with his other hand. Then he nodded towards Tom, who was still staring at the flames.
"Grab him too," he said. "We'll need him when we get there."
"Where?"
Johnny tried to grin.
"Trust me," he said. "Someone has to."
He started to walk. Tom was dragged along with them like a sleepwalker.
"Faster," said Johnny, "or we'll never get there." And then they were all running, all trying to keep up, all causing the others to go faster. And there was the road in that direction.
Johnny took it. The dark landscape lit up in shades of grey like a very old film. The sky went from black to an inky purple, and everything around them looked cold, like crystal. All the leaves and bushes glittering as if they were covered in frost. He couldn't feel the cold. He couldn't feel anything. Johnny ran. The road under his feet was sticky, as though he was trying to sprint in treacle, and the air filled with the noise he'd last heard from the bags, a great whispering rush of sound, like a million radio stations slightly out of tune. Beside him, Joless tried to say something, but no words came out. He pointed with his free hand instead. Blackbury lay ahead of them. It wasn't the town they knew in 1996, and it wasn't the one from 1941 either. It gleamed as cold as starlight on a winter night. Johnny risked a glance behind. There, the sky was red, a deep crimson that brightened to a ruby glow at its centre, and he knew that if he stopped running it would all end. The road would be a road again, the sky would be the sky, but if he just kept going in this direction...
There was a whirring somewhere in the darkness, and a clock began to strike. Johnny listened. They were on the edge of town. There was no traffic in the dark streets, but there were no fires either. There was the muffled sound of laughter from a nearby pub, and the chink of glasses. The clock went on striking. The last note died away. A cat yowled.
11 o'clock, said Kirsty. But we heard 11 o'clock when we were on the downs.
She turned and stared at Johnny. We've got 7 minutes, he said.
Huh?
Said Tom, a man to whom too much had happened and whose brain was floating loose.
To get them to sound the siren, shouted Kirsty.
Huh? The bombs. I saw the fires. It wasn't my fault. The phone...
They haven't fallen, but they will unless you do something right now. On your feet, shouted Kirsty.
No one could resist a voice like that. It went right through the brain and gave its commands directly to the muscles. The police station was at the end of the street. They reached the door in a group and fought one another to get to it. There was an office inside, with a counter running across it to separate the public from the forces of law and order. A policeman was standing behind it. He'd been writing in a large book, but now he was looking up with his mouth open.
"Hello, Tom," he said. "What's going on?"
"You've got to sound the siren," said Johnny. "Right now," said Kirsty.
The sergeant looked from one to the other. Then he turned and glanced at a man in military uniform who was sitting writing at a desk in the office. The sergeant was the sort of man who liked an audience if he thought he was going to be funny.
"Oh, yes," he said. "And why should I do that, then?"
Kirsty's patience, which in any case was only visible with special scientific equipment, came to an end.
"Don't patronise us, you ridiculous buffoon!" she screamed.
The sergeant went red and took a deep breath. Then it was let out suddenly.
"Hey, where do you think you're going?"
Tom had scrambled over the desk. The soldier stood up but was pushed out of the way. The young man reached the switch and pulled it down. Wobbler and Big Mac skulked behind the church.
"They've been gone a long time," said Big Mac.
"It's a long way up there," said Wobbler.
"I'll bet something's happened. They've been shot or something."
"Huh. I thought you liked guns," said Wobbler.
"I don't mind guns. I don't like bullets," said Big Mac. "And I don't want to get stuck here with you."
"We've got the time trolley," said Wobbler. "But do you know how to work it? I reckon you've got to be half mental like Johnny to work it. I don't want to end up fighting Romans or something."
"You won't," said Big Mac.
He froze as he realised what he'd said. Wobbler homed in.
"What do you mean, stuck here with you? What does happen if I don't go home?" he said. "You lot went back to 1996. I wasn't there, right?"
"Oh, you don't want to know any stuff like that," said Big Mac.
"Oh, yeah."
Big Mac was on the floor with Wobbler on top of him. Wobbler might not know how to fight, but he did know how to weigh.
"Get off!"
said Big Mac, flailing around. Trying vicious street fight punches on Wobbler was like hitting a pillow.
"I'm someone else in 1996, aren't I?" said Wobbler. "I bet you know something about me."
"No, no, we never met you."
"I am alive, then. You do know something, right?"
"Get off, I can't breathe."
"Come on, tell me."
"You're not supposed to know what's going to happen."
"Who says? Who says?"
There was a yowl behind him. Wobbler turned his head. Big Mac looked up. Guilty the cat stretched lazily, yawned, and hopped down off the bags. He padded confidently alongside the mossy wall, moving in his lurching diagonal fashion, and disappeared around the building.
"Where's he going?"
said Wobbler.
"How should I know? Get off me!"
The boys followed the cat, who didn't seem at all bothered by their presence. He stopped at the church door and lay down with his front paws outstretched.
"First time I've seen him go away from the trolley," said Big Mac.
And then they heard it. The wail of a siren rose and fell. There were faint noises in Paradise Street. Someone must have moved a blackout curtain because lights showed for a moment. Someone else shouted in a back garden somewhere.
"I've never seen anywhere bombed," said Big Mac. "All we need is popcorn."
"But it's going to happen to real people," said Wobbler,
aware that real people could include him.
"No, because the siren's gone off. They'll all be down in their bomb shelters. That's the whole point. Anyway, it'd happen anyway, right? It's history, OK? It'd be like going back to 1066 and watching the Battle of... whatever it was.
It's not often you get to see an entire pickled onion factory blow up either.
People were certainly moving. Wobbler could hear them in the night. A sound from this end of the street was exactly like someone walking into a tin bath in the darkness. And then,
"Listen," said Big Mac.
There was a faint droning noise.
"Brilliant," said Big Mac.
A door opened. An avenue of yellow light spilled out into the night, and a small figure dashed along it and came to a halt in the middle of the street. It shouted,
"Our Ron will get you!"
The drone filled the sky. Big Mac and Wobbler started running together. They cleared the churchyard steps in one jump and pounded towards the boy, who was dancing around waving a fist at the sky. The aircraft were right overhead. Big Mac got to him first and lifted him off his feet. Then he skidded on the cobbles and turned and headed back towards the church. They were halfway there when they heard the whistling. They were at the top of the steps when the first bomb hit the allotments. They were jumping behind the wall when the second and third bombs hit the pickle factory. They were landing on the grass as the bombs thudded up the street and filled the air with a noise so loud it couldn't be heard, and a light so white it came right through the eyelids, and then the roar picked up the ground and shook it like a blanket. Then there was a sound like a swarm of angry bees, and then there was just the clink of collapsing brickwork and the crackle of fires. Wobbler raised his head very slowly. There were no leaves on the trees behind them, and the trunks sparkled. He got up very slowly and reached out. It was glass. Bits of glass studded the whole trunk of the tree. There were no leaves anymore, just glass. Beside him, Big Mac got to his feet like someone in a dream. A frying pan had hit the church door so hard that it had been driven in halfway, like a very domesticated martial arts weapon. A stone doorstep had smashed a chunk out of the brickwork, and everywhere there was glass, crunching underfoot like permanent hail. It glittered on the walls, reflecting the fire in the ruins. There seemed far too much to be from just a few house windows. And then it began to rain. First it rained vinegar, and then it rained pickles. There was red liquid all over Big Mac. He licked a finger and then held it up.
"Tomato sauce!"
A gherkin bounced off Wobbler's head. Big Mac started to laugh. People can start laughing for all sorts of reasons, but sometimes they laugh because, against all expectations, they're still alive and have a mouth left to laugh with.
"You," he tried to say, "you... you... you want fries with that?"
It was the funniest thing Wobbler had ever heard. Right now, it was the funniest thing anyone had ever said anywhere. He laughed until the tears ran down his face and mingled with the mustard pickle. From somewhere in the shadows by the wall, a small voice said,
"Did anyone get any shrapnel?"
There wasn't a whole house left standing. Roofs had gone, windows had blown out. Half of the buildings had simply vanished into rubble, which spilled out across the street. Bells rang in the distance. Two fire engines skidded to a halt right outside the church. An ambulance pulled up behind them.
"You want..." Big Mac began. "Shut up, will you?" said Wobbler.
There were fires everywhere. Big fires, little fires. The pickle factory was well alight and smelt like the biggest fish and chip shop in the world. People were running from every direction. Some of them were pulling at the rubble. There was a lot of shouting.
"I suppose everyone would have got out right," said Wobbler. "They would have got out, wouldn't they?"
What Big Mac said afterwards was that he'd never intended to help. It had been like watching a film until he'd seen people scrabbling at the wreckage, so he'd stepped through the screen. And Wobbler said afterwards that he could remember three things. One was the strange metallic clinking sound bricks make as piles of them slide around. One was the smell of wet burnt wood. And one was the bed. The blast had taken off the roof and half the walls of a house, but there was a double bed hanging out over the road. It even still had the sheets on it. It creaked up and down in the wind. Fences had been laid flat, sheds had been lifted up and dealt like cards across the gardens, and, as though the all-clear had been the last trump, shelter doors were opening and people were rising out of the ground.
"I just hope the others are still there," said Kirsty as they ran through the streets.
"What do you think?" said Joless.
"Sorry?"
I mean, maybe they're sitting quietly waiting for us, or they've got into some kind of trouble. Bets, said Yoles. They reached the church just as Wobbler and Big Mac came up the street. Why are you covered in soot, you two? Asked Kirsty.
We've been rescuing people, said Wobbler proudly.
They looked at the wreckage of Paradise Street. People were standing around in small groups and sitting on the ruins. Some ladies in official-looking hats had set up a table with a tea urn on it. There were still a few small fires, however, and the occasional crash and tinkle as a high-altitude cocktail onion fell back to earth in a coating of ice. Johnny stared.
Everyone got out, Johnny, said Wobbler, watching him carefully.
I know.
The siren was just in time.
I know.
Behind him, Johnny heard Kirsty say, I hope they get counselling.
They get a nice cup of tea and told to cheer up because it could be worse, said Big Mac.
That's all? Well, there's biscuits too.
Johnny watched the street.
The firelight almost made it look cheerful, and his mind's eye saw the other street. It was here too, happening at the same time. There were the same fires and the same piles of rubble and the same fire engines, but there were no people, except the ones carrying stretchers.
We're in a new time, he thought.
Everything you do changes everything, and every time you move in time, you arrive in a time a little bit different to the one you left. What you do doesn't change the future, just a future. There's millions of times when the bombs killed everyone in Paradise Street, but it didn't happen here.
The ghostly images faded away as the other time veered off into its own future.
Johnny shook his head. Trolley, he said. It was waiting where they'd left it, but there was no sign of guilty.
Oh, no, said Kirsty. We're not going to look for a cat.
He went to watch the bombing, said Wobbler. Don't know what happened to him after that.
Johnny gripped the handle of the trolley. The bags creaked in the darkness. Don't worry about the cat, he said. Cats find their own way home. The Golden Threads Club occupied the old church on Friday mornings. Sometimes there was a folk singer or entertainment from local schools, if this couldn't be avoided. Mainly, there was tea and a chat. There was a change in the air, and five figures appeared. Said Johnny.
Is this the theatre group?
Said Kirsty. The others were astonished at her quick thinking.
Oh, no, wrong church hall, very sorry.
They edged towards the door, pushing the trolley. The threaders watched them owlishly, teacups cooling in their hands. The air outside smelt of 1996. Kirsty looked at her watch.
10:30 on Saturday morning, she said. Not bad.
Your watch is at 10:30 on Saturday morning, said Johnny. That doesn't mean we are.
Good point, but I think we are anyway. This all looks right.
Looks fine to me, said Wobbler.
We've been out all night, said Yoles. My mum will go spare.
Tell her you stopped at my place and the phone was broken, said Wobbler.
I don't like lying.
Are you going to tell her the truth?
Yoles thought for a few agonised seconds.
Your phone was broken, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell my mum I was staying at your place, said Wobbler.
I shouldn't think my grandad's noticed I'm not in, said Johnny. He always drops off in front of the telly.
My parents have a very modern outlook, said Kirsty.
My brother doesn't mind where I am so long as the police don't come round, said Big Mac.
Before time travelling to any extent, Johnny thought, you should always get your alibi sorted out. They met up an hour later in the Mall. The burger bar was back to the way it had always been. That jogged Johnny's memory.
Yes. We've got this letter for you, Wobbler.
He pulled it out. It was crumpled and covered in vinegar and sooty fingerprints.
It's for you, he repeated. Someone asked us to give it to you.
Yeah, someone, said Yoles. We don't know who he was, said Big Mac. A completely mysterious person, so it's no use you asking us questions.
Wobbler gave them a suspicious look and ripped open the envelope.
Go on, what's it say? Said Big Mac.
Dumb stuff, said Wobbler. Read it yourself.
Johnny took the paper that had been in the envelope. It contained a list numbered from 1 to 10. 1, eat healthy food in moderation, he read. 2,
An hour's exercise every day is essential. 3. Invest money wisely in a mixture of...
What's the point of all this junk? It's the sort of thing granddads say, said Wobbler. Why'd anyone want to tell me that? You'd have to be some kind of loony to go around telling people that. This was one of those religious blokes that hang around in the Mall, right? I thought it might be something important.
Johnny glanced at the burger bar and sighed deeply.
There've been changes, said Kirsty. Clark Street isn't Clark Street anymore. I noticed that when I went past. It's Evershot Street.
That's frightening, said Big Mac. A street name was mysteriously changed.
I thought it was always Evershot Street, said Yoles.
Me too, said Wobbler.
And that shop over there, they used to sell cards and things. Now it's a jeweller's, said Kirsty insistently. The boys craned around to look at it.
It's always been a jeweller's, hasn't it? Said Wobbler.
He yawned. Well, you're an unobservant bunch. I... Kirsty began.
Hold on, said Johnny. How did you get all those cuts on your hands, Wobbler? You too, Big Mac.
Well,
Wobbler's eyes glazed.
We were messing around, said Big Mac.
Weren't we?
Yeah, messing around somewhere, said Yoles.
Don't you remember... Kirsty began.
Forget about it, said Johnny. Come on, Kirsty. We've got to go.
Where to?
Visiting time. We've got to go to see Mrs. Tachyon.
Kirsty waved a hand frantically at the other three.
But they don't seem to... It doesn't matter. Come on.
Mrs. Tachyon had gone. The ward sister seemed quite angry about it when Johnny and Kirsty met her. Mrs. Tachyon had gone to the lavatory, it seemed. She'd locked herself in, and in the end, they'd had to get someone to take the lock off in case she'd fallen down in there. She wasn't in there at all. They were three floors up, and the window was too small even for someone as skinny as Mrs. Tachyon to climb through.
Was there any toilet paper? Said Johnny.
The sister gave him a look of deep suspicion.
The whole roll's gone, she said.
Johnny nodded. That sounded like Mrs. Tachyon.
And the headphones have vanished, said the sister. Do you know about any of this? You've been visiting her. That's only because it's, you know, like a project, said Kirsty defensively.
She sidled closer to Johnny.
Where did you leave the trolley? Behind our garage, he said. Do you think she's taken it?
Yes, he said happily. Johnny was quiet on the bus home. They'd gone to the library, and he'd wangled a photocopy of the local paper for the day after the raid. There was a picture of people looking very cheerful in the ruins of Paradise Street. Of course, things were pretty faded now, but there was Mrs. Density with a goldfish bowl, and Wobbler's grandfather with a bit of bomb, and just behind them, grinning and holding his thumb up, you could just make out Wobbler. It hadn't been a good photo to start with, and it hadn't improved with age, and he had soot all over his face, but if you knew it was Wobbler, you could see it was him all right.
They're all forgetting except me, thought Johnny.
You've gone very quiet, said Kirsty. I was just thinking, said Johnny. I was thinking that if I showed the others this piece from the paper, they'd say, oh, yeah, that looks like old Wobbler, so what?
Kirsty leant across.
Oh, yes, she said.
Well, it does look like Wobbler. So what?
Johnny stared out of the window.
I mean, he said, it's Wobbler. In the paper, remember?
Remember what?
Well, yesterday?
She wrinkled her forehead.
Didn't we go to some sort of party?
Johnny's heart sank.
It's your stop, said Kirsty.
Are you all right?
No, said Johnny, and got off the bus. It was raining heavily, but he went and checked to see if the trolley was where he'd left it.
It wasn't. On the other hand, maybe it had never been there at all. When he went up to his bedroom, he could hear the rain drumming on the roof. He'd vaguely hoped that he might have been a different person in this world, but there it all was, the same bedroom, the same mess, the same space shuttle on its bit of red wool, the same stuff for the project all over the table. He sat on his bed and watched the rain for a while. He could feel the shadows in the air hovering around the corners of the room. He'd lost Mrs. Tachyon's paper somewhere. That would have been proof. But no one else would believe it. He could remember it all. The rain on the moor, the thunderstorm, the sting on his whole body when they'd run through time, And it hadn't happened. Not exactly. Normal, dull, boring, everyday life had just poured right in again. Johnny went through his pockets. If only there was something. His fingers touched a piece of card. The sound of Australian accents from downstairs suggested that his granddad was in. He trailed downstairs and into the little front room. "Granddad?"
"Yes?"
said his grandfather, who was watching Cobbers. "You know, the war..."
"Yes?"
"You know you said that before you went in the army you were a sort of aircraft spotter?"
"Got a medal for it," said his grandfather.
He picked up the remote control and switched off the set, which never usually happened.
"Showed it you, didn't I? Must have done."
"Don't think so," said Johnny, as diplomatically as possible. Before, his grandfather had always told him not to go on. Finally, after much grunting, his granddad produced a small wooden box and opened it.
"They said they never knew how I done it," he said proudly. "But Mr. Hodder and Captain Harris spoke up for me." "Oh, yes. Had to be possible," they said. "Otherwise I couldn't have done it, could I? The phones had got hit by lightning and the bike wouldn't start. So I had to run all the way down into the town."
Johnny turned the silver medal over in his hands. There was a yellowing bit of paper with it, badly typed by someone who hadn't changed the ribbon on his typewriter for years. "Gallant action," he read, "ensuring the safety of the people of Blackberry." "Some men from the Olympics came to see me after the war," said his grandfather, "but I told them I didn't want any."
"How did you do it?" said Johnny.
"They said someone's watch must have been wrong," said Grandad. "I don't know about that, I just ran for it. It's all a bit of a blur now, to tell you the truth."
He put the medal back in the box. Beside it, held together with an elastic band, was a grubby pack of cards. Johnny took them out and removed the band. They had aircraft on them. Johnny reached into his pocket and took out the five of clubs. It was a lot less worn, but there was no doubt that it was part of the pack. He slipped it under the band and put the pack back in the box. Grandad and Johnny sat and looked at one another for a moment. There was no sound but the rain and the ticking of the mantelpiece clock. Johnny felt the time drip around them, thick as amber. Then Grandad blinked, picked up the remote control and aimed it at the TV.
"Anyway, we've all passed a lot of water under the bridge since those days," he said.
And that was that. The doorbell rang. Johnny trooped out into the hall. The bell rang again, urgently. Johnny opened the door. "Oh," he said gloomily. "Hello, Kirsty." Rain had plastered her hair to her head.
"I ran back from the next stop," she said.
"Huh? Why?" She held up a pickled onion.
"I found it in my pocket and I remembered. We did go back."
"Not back," said Johnny. "It's more like there." The elation rose up inside him like a big pink cloud.
"Come on in. Everything. Even the pickles."
"Good.
I thought I ought to tell you."
"Right.
Do you think Mrs. Tachyon will ever find her cat?"
Johnny nodded. "Wherever he is," he said. The sergeant and the soldier picked themselves up off the ground and staggered towards the wreckage where the house had been.
"That poor old Biddy, that poor old Biddy," said the sergeant.
"Do you think she might have got out in time? She was sort of close to the wall," moaned the soldier.
"The house isn't there anymore. What do you think?"
They scrambled through the damp ruins of Paradise Street.
She got any relatives?" said the soldier.
"No. No one been here ages. My dad says he remembers seeing her about sometimes when he was a lad," said the sergeant.
He removed his helmet.
"Poor old Biddy," he said. "That's what you think. Dinner, 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 dinner."
They turned. A skinny figure, wearing an old coat over a nightdress and a woolly hat, ran along the road, expertly steering a wire cart between the mounds of rubble.
"Dinner, dinner."
The sergeant stared at the soldier.
"How did she do that? Search me." "Dinner, dinner, Batman."
Some way away,
Guilty ambled in his sideways fashion through the back streets. He'd had an interesting morning hunting through the remains of Paradise Street, and had passed some quality time during the afternoon in the ruins of the pickle factory, where there were mice, some of them fried. It had been a good day. Around him, Blackberry went back to sleep. Guilty waited, washing himself. After a while, he looked up as a familiar squeaking sound came around the corner and stopped. Guilty hopped up onto the trolley. Mrs. Tachyon reached up and adjusted the headphones under her bobble hat. She scratched at a surgical dressing. Dratted thing. She'd have to get someone to take it off her. But she knew a decent nurse over in 1917. Then she scrabbled in her pockets and fished out the sixpence the sergeant had given her. She remembered him giving it to her. Mrs. Tachyon remembered everything, and had long ago given up wondering whether the things she remembered had already happened or not. Take life as it was going to come was her motto, and if it didn't come, go and fetch it. The past and the future were all the same, but you could get a good feed off of her sixpence if you knew the right way to do it. She squinted at it in the grey light of dawn. It was a bit old and grubby, but the date was quite clear. It said 1903.
Tea and buns, that's what you think, Mr. Copper.
And she went back to 1903 and spent it on fish and chips, and still had change.